12. The End of Time.
I take a moment to steady myself. Curse my mortal shell, but I am old, and I am tired. I consider resuming my seat for a moment, just a moment, to ease my old bones, but that would be a symbol of weakness. He mustn't think me weak. He will not be able to trust me if he thinks me weak. Yet the rising, world-drowning tide of the immaterium hammers and burns at my soul. I feel my lord fight to adjust and correct, recrafting the invisible, constructing and reinforcing talismanic dikes and dams of psychanic force, opening psychomantic outfalls and conduits to relieve the rising pressure. It is growing ever more disturbed by the moment. In the great chamber of the Golden Throne, astropaths moan and spasm, bedeviled by unbidden dreams, and the Oniero looms spew friction smoke as they spin too fast. Prophesiers weep, lamenting, and prognosticators bleed from the mouth and ears. Indifference engines judder on their platforms, and Archaeotech valves spit green and yellow sparks. What new surge racks the currents of the webway? Keeping it chained is a constant, precise struggle. I wonder, will I be remotely prepared for it when my turn comes? Will... Another surge. I feel the throne sigh as it shudders and rides the empiric current, its amplifiers and stasis nodes straining. What is causing this fresh perturbation? My mind sight turns upwards. Peerless terror falls ever further into the void wound Horus has cut. A caustic halo surrounds it utterly, so that it resembles a great inflamed, infected eye. The nephelosphere around it burns black, like the petals of a monstrous poisoned flower. Arcs of morbid lightning, millions of kilometers long, lashing across the solar realm. The forces of two universes, cosmic opposites, mingle and intermix, contrary to the absolute laws of cosmological regulation. The warp and real space are beginning to devour each other. Cannibal galaxies starting to feed, to consume, to mutually obliterate. The Empyrean will win, of course, for it is malevolently hungry in a way our cold and starry void is not. And there, hanging over us still, is his utterly vengeful spirit. Unlike every other vessel in the vast murder fleet circling the skies of terror like carrion birds, it remains unguarded. Its shields are still down. It is wantonly, brazenly exposed. A threat? An invitation? A seductive promise? He thinks he's luring us into a fatal mistake, except this is not his work at all. It is a scheme devised by the four behind him, the four anagogic annihilators who govern him. His role is merely their impatient host. The four are allowing him to believe that this is a tactical masterstroke, a summons my lord and master cannot refuse. Horus Lupercal accepts this. He seeks gratification and triumph. My lord's first found was always so very eager. Flagrantly, he shows us the trap he thinks he has set and beckons to us. Well, you once wonderful son, you peevish traitor child, it is a trap indeed, but not for your father. In your pride and confidence, intoxicated by the power you have so unwisely drunk, you have built your own demise. So, is it that? Is it that indecently bared flagship, shamelessly revealed, that suddenly perturbs the warp so, and makes the Neverborn shriek and gyrate with expectation? That makes the noctivagant horrors in the burning streets of the Dominions gibber with glee? That makes the webway roar? I think perhaps it is. Demonkind quivers, salivating at the prospect of the coming moment, and... No. No, it is not. It is something else. I feel the pattern of it. The particular gust and eddy of the immaterial gale beneath my lord's adytum. Impossible. Too soon, surely. And yet, in my mind, he warns me to brace myself. I feel him take control at once, applying full and conscious mastery of the turbulent Everseas. Warding bells and klaxons sound automatically. The armory procession halts, bewildered. The custodians stand ready, spears raised. The sisters unsheathe their blades and their anti-souls. The conclaves of the Adnecta Concilium scurry to and fro, adjusting flow regulation and dynamic connection. The lights of the vast electro-flambeau hung along the arched and echoing nave flutter and dim. 100 centuries of noetic learning and practice guides his hand. My lord and master opens the webway door. Withering light floods out, scorching the flagstones and crusting the auramite fittings of the chamber with fulgurite soot. By his will alone, my lord holds the ether back long enough for the figure to emerge. Then, as his will ebbs and frays, he closes the door again, clamps the telethesic locks, throws bolts forged from the heavy metals of white dwarf stars, re-engages the dampers and rekindles the wards. The light fades. The chamber floor before the golden throne is spattered with ectoplasmic fluid and fuming pools of ooze and waste wash. Spavined and translucent things from nowhere, biblow organisms from the deep trenches of the warp, splash and twitch and flop and gasp, unable to survive in a world they were not made for. They die, decay and liquefy in the light and air of the throne room, leaving nothing but puddles of putrid jelly and a lingering odour of decomposition. And there he stands, amid the spatter of bio-organic emulsion, whole and home, the acrid vapours of the webway rising like smoke from his shoulders. Vulcan, the Promethean sun. I share the astonishment of all those gathered here. Vulcan turns and kneels to his father, head bowed. I see Rogel and Sanguinius start and hurry forward, pushing past the halted line of the armourers. Vulcan has returned. Joy fills me at the sight of him, but just as quickly, dread. He was hours away when my mind last visited him, clawing his half-dead, half-living way back along the psychoplastic halls. I doubted he would return before it was time for his father to leave.
Lord Father,
he says, the low voice of a flexing fault line.
I feared I was coming too late. Whole ages it has taken me to reach your side.
And then I understand. It is an alarming thing to realize that even I can be mistaken in my reading of signs. Vulcan's sense of time, just like his father's, just like mine, is born of the perpetual and runs outside the mortal flow of hours. But our perceptions here are contradictory. Instants have become centuries, and years moments, for him and for us in different ways. I understand now the full degree of the damage wrought upon Terra. The last walls are falling, the sun is red, and the clocks. The clocks do more than just run down and disagree. The ruin of the warp so afflicts the materia of Terra that dimensions have collapsed. Space and distance, time and duration, those constant and trustworthy arbiters of real space, have ceased and fallen. Time, a local foible of our reality, no longer counts. It is no longer our ally or our rival. The palace and all of Terra and all of us have become pinned in the infinite now of the Empyrean, and we will remain there until the grip of chaos is broken. This is Nevernus, the abdication of metaphysical continuity. This is the unmoving Yugabalak of the Webway's Singularity Node. This is untime. There will be no tomorrow, for there is no longer a today or a yesterday. There will be no tomorrow unless we wrench terror from the sucking wound of the warp and allow space and time to reformulate according to Euclidean and Minkowskian principles. The four, the false four, know this. To them, this is a step closer to triumph, depriving us of orthodox reality. To them, this is the final state of madness that will carry us off. I think on this in despair, and then I start to chuckle to myself. They have, because they do not understand it, forgotten logic. The foul false four have forgotten that we still think in human terms and plan human plans according to human conceptions. They have denied us tomorrow, but if tomorrow is the fall of terror, then we have been strenuously denying that for months. By melting time away and condemning us to neverness, they have given us a moment of eternity, an endless now in which to forge the tomorrow of our choosing.
In the Webway, my father,
Vulcan says.
As I walked, I heard a name. It came from the walls and the air, again and again.
The Dark King? I ask. Vulcan glances around at the sound of my voice and the soft tap of my approaching staff.
Lord Regent,
he says, and rises to his feet. I shuffle forward, leaning heavily on my staff until I am alongside him. I reach up and pat him on the shoulder, an avuncular greeting. Then I eye the splatter on the flagstones around us, dubiously probing one rotting lump of dead flesh with the tip of my staff. I wrinkle my nose. Was it the Dark King? I ask again. Vulcan, the name, my boy. Was it the Dark King?
It was, Lord Sigilite,
Vulcan replies. Yes, I have heard it too, I tell him.
And what does it mean?
Asks Sanguinius, as he and Rogel join us at the foot of the great dais.
It is a title sometimes claimed by curs,
says Dawn.
And, I understand, an element of the tarot.
He glances at me warily. He knows full well my fluency in the language of symbols. Though it seems like years past, it is only months ago that I gave Dawn a private reading, in which, following the reveal of the moon, the martyr, the monster, and the lightning tower, the Dark King turned to lie askew across the Emperor. I place great credence in the working of the cards, and consider my old deck an especially prized possession. But dear Dawn has no stomach for such superstitious frippery, and he is annoyed that this bothers him. Yes, I reply. It signifies Conrad, and also the name of an ill-favoured card in the Tarot Arcanoi. But in this case, my dear Praetorian, both definitions are mere echoes of the real truth. I look up at the golden throne, raising a hand to shield my eyes from the glare. Will you tell them? I ask. He tells me that I speak for him in all things. Very well, I say. I turn to the three great Primarch sons. It means, I say, the end and the death.